702. The Naked Scientist.
Time for the Naked Scientist. I hope you've got all of your science related questions standing by for Dr. Chris Smith. 011-883-0702, the WhatsApp line 072-702-1702. Happy Monday, Doctor. How are you doing?
Doctor? I was just clicking the unmute button so that you couldn't tell me I was on mute. I'm very good. How are you?
I am good, and I had a question I've been dying to ask you. Are you ready?
I can barely contain myself. I'm just joking. Go on.
So I was looking at, people post a million things on social media, but this specific post was talking about colon cleansing. And many people believe in things like enemas, but colon cleansing specifically, is it something that's actually a necessity that a person should be getting their colon cleansed, or these are just excessive things that aren't necessary? But they were speaking as if a colon cleansing is absolutely necessary.
I tend to take the approach, whenever anyone asks me a question like that, I always step back and I say, well, until we came along with all our modern medical advice, what would our ancestors have done? Because that's a really good guide, because there are now billions of people on Earth. So clearly we're quite successful as a species, and we've been around for millions of years as an emerging and evolving species. So what our ancestors did probably is A, good advice for us to live by anyway, and B, because they were just doing what came naturally to them, their bodies would have evolved and adapted to what they had available to do, or what would have been best for their long-term survival. Because if they did stuff that was too deleterious, they would have been deleted from the gene pool, and that behavior would have died out because populations would have stopped doing it. So in this respect, did our ancestors, did cavemen and cavewomen do colonic irrigation? Well, probably not. They might have done the odd thing where if there was something that obviously was wrong, they might have administered a medicine or thought perhaps we'll do this under an exceptional circumstance. But healthy people, no, I don't think they would have done. And so for that reason, I think this is a bit like people who say you shouldn't eat this or you shouldn't eat that. Obviously, if it's something poisonous, don't eat that. But
yes,
a varied mixed diet, there's no one thing that if you eat loads of it, it's going to be really good, or none of it that's going to be really good. It's all about balance, and it's what would have come naturally, what people would have done historically with what they had available to them. So I think the answer to this question is, if it floats your boat and you do that from time to time, it's probably not going to do you any harm. Does your health improve because of it? Almost certainly not. Your wallet's health, the health of your bank account, definitely will not improve because of it. I would save your money.
So does that also apply to, in South Africa, people will say, as in you feel like you need to clean your stomach, and then they will drink laxatives maybe like after festive season or after a heavy night of drinking, which we could simply just refer to as a detox. Does it also apply to a person feeling like, I need to clean my tummy, I've been eating badly, I need to, in inverted commas, detox?
But where's the evidence that if you actually do that, you're any better off? And in fact, you might be doing yourself more harm. A good example of this, a few years back, people, experts, in inverted commas, said you shouldn't eat loads of nuts when you're pregnant because this may make your future children nut allergic. And people have done careful epidemiological studies. Australia, really good example. They put the kibosh on people eating peanuts in pregnancy, and they then saw a huge increase in peanut allergies in the next generation of youngsters. And we don't know that one thing caused the other, but there's a very strong association there. So then the advice was reversed. There's no evidence whatsoever that if you don't eat peanuts when you're pregnant, that you're going to have children who won't have a peanut allergy. In fact, we've probably got the reverse. People have now reinstated, eat sensible handfuls of nuts when you're pregnant. Peanut allergy rates have gone down again. So I think one has to be very careful about sudden authoritarian advice. Do this because if it's got good clinical evidence, they'll be able to show it to you. If they can't present the clinical evidence that there's a good, properly controlled set of data that were collected in an unbiased way that support that course of action, don't do it. Don't believe it or ask to see it. And when you do see it, then you can make an appraisal.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Chris Smith. The lines are open, 011-883-0702. The WhatsApp line, 072-702-1702. First question that's come through on the SMS line, 31702, says, please would you ask the Naked Scientist if they can use the power of the breaking waves in the sea to generate electricity? It could be a plan for South Africa. Thank you.
Well, we do have ways of collecting wave power. By the time the wave breaks, you could argue that a lot of the energy is being wasted because it's much harder to harvest meaningfully. So what they tend to do is to try and harvest the energy out at sea, because the displacement of the wave might be smaller, but you can make your device so it's better at capturing the energy in a sustainable and useful way. So the way people are tending to do this is to anchor or moor devices offshore, and because the sea rises and falls rhythmically with the passing waves, you have things which are articulated. So the one design they've got looks a bit like a space rocket, a long caterpillar like space rocket, and it's arranged against the advancing direction of the wave, so perpendicular to the wavefront. So as the wave goes along the caterpillar, each of the sections of the caterpillar bends and goes upwards, downwards, upwards, downwards, like it's wriggling. And each of those articulations is extracting some energy from the wave and being used to drive a generating device. Another way of doing it, you anchor buoys onto the seafloor, as in these are the floating things. I don't mean small children. We're not allowed to do that anymore. You anchor the buoys on the seafloor, and as the wave goes through, because the buoy is buoyant, it's floating, it's pulled upwards and then drops down, upwards and drops down. And so you're transmitting a force down through the anchorage of the buoy, and you can have some kind of generating device subsea on the seafloor. These are currently industry best standard ways of extracting energy from waves. Trying to get it from breaking waves, much more tricky and much, much easier for the device to be broken. And you'd be spending more money, more time, more energy probably on repairing your device than you actually saved by having a wave-powered device at the seashore. Better to do it further out at sea.
All right. Baba Lo says, hi, Rilebkhile, can the doctor please explain the reason, in brackets, psychology, behind the human behavior of changing for the better when it's too late? For example, one toxic partner in a romantic relationship will keep on doing the wrong things over and over until the other partner stops caring and is mentally checking out. Only then the toxic partner will start showing change of behavior by apologizing and actually working themselves. Doctor, before you give the scientific explanation, I'm going to simply say, because you made the stakes high. Some people only respond when the stakes are high. You know, if you're asking and asking and they think, well, she's sticking around anyways, why should I change? Until the day you're ready to leave. Then when they feel you pulling away, suddenly they freaked out at the realization that you will leave.
Not just human relationships, though, is it? It's our relationship with the environment, with the planet, with pretty much anything we do. We tend to be creatures of habit. We're very bad at changing our minds once we've made them up. Once we've got a course of action, we have to be persuaded, in many instances, to do something differently. If you have to do something differently, it involves effort. And because we're inherently quite lazy, we've evolved to try to conserve energy. And that's why most of the population are on the course towards gaining too much weight these days. We tend to do the least possible. And if you want to change something, that usually takes effort and energy. And so people have to have a very compelling reason to change, whether that's their carbon emissions, their water usage, or, as you point out, people's behavior in relationships. We also get stuck in our ways, and for good reasons. Wouldn't life be difficult if you learn something and then the next day had forgotten it and had to learn it again? Mm. So we get things into our head, we fix them, and that helps us in many, many contexts, many, many circumstances. You learn something, you learn it once, you know it for life. Problem is, when it becomes your entrenched behavior, then you've got that extra hurdle that it's a fixed behavior and you've got to disabuse someone of doing things that way, get them doing things a new way, and then get them to settle into what we're dubbing the new normal these days. And that takes effort. And unfortunately, we don't like exerting ourselves, so we don't do it.
Mm, thank you so much. And Baba Lo, also just keep in mind that, and I don't know what your thoughts are here, Doctor, sometimes a person can change behavior temporarily just to revert back to the status quo. So I hope that resolves the issue for you in whatever it is that you're going through at the moment. Let's go to the lines. We have Penelope Ann. Hi, Penelope in Sandton. Go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Dr. Smith, I would like to challenge you on your statement that nothing can be remedied, cured. I may be wrong. I would like you to put me right. Without scientific evidence, there is a multitude of evidence where an ailment can be cured through the knowledge of nutrition. And what you, depending on what your knowledge is, how much you've studied, etc., the ailment can be cured.
Was this around the question I was asking, doctor, with regards to colon cleansings and detoxing?
No. He stated at the beginning that you need scientific evidence.
Let me just clarify, because what I actually said was, if someone's trying to convince you of a course of action, I'm paraphrasing slightly, then, and they're telling you this is a good thing to do, this is the right thing for you to do, then they should be able to support their argument, if you're at all nervous about their argument, with solid scientific or medical evidence. Because if they can't provide that, then they haven't actually got any grounds to convince that they're right and you're not. So if they're trying to convince you to do something differently, eat something different, take a different medicine, take more or less exercise in a different sort of way, and they make health claims for it, the only reason they can make those health claims with any authority is if they have supporting data. If they don't have the data, then your word is as good as mine. That's not to say that your word's wrong or my word's more right. What it's saying is that if someone is trying to tell you that you should do something a certain way, the only reason they must know that is if they have strong data, which has been collected in an impartial, unbiased and preferably double-blinded way, so that it's had the gold standard statistics done on it, and they can say, this is the case. I didn't at any point say you can't cure something without the evidence, because otherwise we'd never discover anything, wouldn't we? We have to try things and gain evidence. But it's when someone has argumentation against you that says, you're doing this wrong, you should do it this way. Well, where's their evidence? Because the only way you can make a comparison like that is if you've genuinely done the study and got the data.
Thank you so much, Doctor, for that clarity, and Penelope for the question. And Doctor, I mean, my view is I believe in the placebo effect. And what I mean by that is, Even if somebody says this hardly ever works, it only works 10% of the time, for the mere fact that I did something, like let's say my throat is sore and somebody said, you know, you must snort cayenne pepper, and I don't have evidence, something in my brain tells me you did something, and then I feel better. And then I say, even if the meds don't work, I want to feel better. So isn't that worth it?
Well, the placebo effect is really powerful. And in fact, it's taken into account when we do clinical trials, because we do a double-blind placebo-controlled trial very often. And there you take people who have a condition and you say to them, we're going to put you in this trial and you'll either get a placebo or you'll get the real treatment. And you won't know, and I won't know until the end of the trial. And so therefore, if there is a placebo effect, it will be inherent to both groups. And any difference that emerges will be the difference genuinely because of the intervention rather than just the placebo effect. Because everyone who gets enrolled in a clinical trial, by and large, tends to do better than people who are not in a clinical trial for all kinds of reasons. So the placebo effect is very important. It's appreciated and it's taken into account.
All right. Thank you so much, Doctor. Let's go to Jay in Pretoria. Jay, go ahead.
Ma'am, I'd like to link two of your guests. Your guest earlier, the Bush lady, was talking about early childhood development and 3,000 words and things like that. But here's my question to the doctor. If a lady is pregnant and you put headphones over the lady's stomach where the embryo is developing, and you link that to e-books or the same math theorems and science and violin music, would that make the baby develop smarter when the baby is born, or would it have no effect?
Can I ask a question? In this scenario, is the dad smart as well?
Well, it's the dad that's calling, not the mum, right?
Because I heard that kids get intelligence from the mom. Doctor, can you come in here on this one? Because I think that would play a factor. Both the parents are not that bright. I mean, will the headphones make a difference?
Well, you know what they said? It's like Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe. And he said, my looks and your brains. Imagine what would happen if we had kids like that. But the bottom line here is that it does seem to make a difference. And people have been doing studies on this over many years. And they've been looking at this even recently. There was a lady I spoke to, Judith Gervin, who is in Padua in Italy. She looked at children in Paris who are newborns. And she played them a nursery rhyme in three different languages. Not a nursery rhyme, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. In little bits of that, in three different languages when they were born. English, which they'd never heard, French, which their mums were, and Spanish, which they presumably never heard either. And they monitored the brain activity of these kids, and they found that even when they were newborn, they were listening more intently and showing different changes in their brain activity when they heard the French rendition of Goldilocks compared to the two foreign languages. And her suggestion, her deduction from that, was that because the babies have been listening to mum's voice all the way through her pregnancy, they've already got attuned to the cadence, the content of, and the way of speaking French compared to those other languages. So their brain automatically latched onto that more than the other languages. So we know that there is some evidence that this probably happens. And another recent study looked at if you play tunes to children that they have heard when they've been in utero and then when they're born, and you again see that they tend to respond more to tunes that they have heard, in inverted commas, when their mum was pregnant, compared to tunes that are foreign to them, suggesting that there is a learning process going on in utero. And this all fits, because at the end of the day, the brain puts itself together in a roughly mapped out way, where some parts of the brain connect to other parts of the brain in a rough way. And it's a bit like having a roughly honed piece of marble from which you're going to carve a beautiful sculpture. And the beautiful sculpture, the carving process, is done by experience. So once you're born and you start to experience things, then that rough map is transformed into a highly honed, perfected map of how your eyes are going to work, how your ears are going to work, how your language skills are going to work. And that starts in utero, probably from about 20 weeks onwards.
Okay, so are we doing the headphones, doctor? Is that what you're saying?
I think not. I think that because there are so many sounds, incidental sounds, hitting that lady, the baby's tuning into a mum's voice, mum snoring, mum's bowel sounds. Every time mum goes to the loo, baby's going to hear that. And we know sounds from the environment go through as well, because there was a study done by the American military about 20 years ago. Because as we begin to recruit more women into the forces, we need to be very conscious of the fact that some of them may well be pregnant at the time. And if they are, and they're subject to loud sounds and incidental noises, there could be an occupational harm that we need to take into account and protect against. So they did experiments. They used sheep that were pregnant, but they're a good model for a human that's pregnant. And they put tiny microphones inside the uterus into the ear canal of the developing lamb and a microphone outside the sheep, and played various sounds to see how the two compared. And the lamb was certainly able to hear, based on the recordings from these microphones, what was going on in the environment, even though the sound was being transmitted through the mum, through the wall of the uterus and the fluid, and then into the lamb. It will obviously attenuate the higher frequencies, so it's going to get more lower frequencies. So if mum's got a deep voice, the baby's going to hear more of mum's voice than if mum's got a high voice. But you're going to get those sounds, and the baby, for most of your pregnancy, has been eavesdropping on what you're saying. So watch what you say.
All right, and I've got homework for you, Dr. Chris Smith, for next week, around how can you make your baby or your child perfect pitch, and what's different in the brain of an individual who's perfect pitched. I look forward to your response next week, Monday. Dr. Chris Smith, thank you so much.